Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Before I start, I just want to stress that I'm not going to talk about the Catholic imagination in a theoretical way. So this is not going to be a lecture of philosophy or theology. It will be more of a journey into the human experience of Oscar Wilde. And I think in general, it's good to talk about the life of an author to understand the work. But I think especially this is the case for Oscar Wilde, whose life and work were deeply intertwined, and who always framed, if you want, his life as a work of art, and his art as his life work. So in a sense, life and work are really together for Oscar Wilde. And I like to talk about Oscar Wilde because I do think that Oscar Wilde is a prophetic writer, and as you're going to hear soon, that's also a way to introduce the content of the Catholic imagination, the idea of prophecy. Literature is somehow prophetic, and certainly Oscar Wilde is a prophetic because he anticipates in many ways the post-Christian world, or at least the world that we are living. I think now with the wars that happened in the past couple of years, I think we have lost a bit of our optimism, but certainly there is still a lot of glitter in the world that we live, especially in the West, and Oscar Wilde has been heralded as the prophet by many quarters of all that, and to a certain extent this is true. But at the same time, there is another side of Oscar Wilde to complete, if you want, not to oppose the other side, but to complete the personality of Oscar Wilde that would be somehow at the center of my lecture tonight. I will therefore try to explore the human depths of Oscar Wilde together, not because I want to Christianize Tolkien. Yes, not Tolkien. Tolkien is, of course, a Christian. Tolkien is always there in my mind. I don't want to Christianize or even Catholicize Oscar Wilde. I'm more interested in his experience as a human being, in his, we may say, wounded humanity, a humanity that was wounded. And I'm interested because I really do consider Oscar Wilde as a friend who helped me to face my own wounded humanity and therefore to rediscover in a real way the convenience of faith, to quote another key figure somehow related to Oscar Wilde with John Henry Newman. Faith needs to be real, and that's why I think going to the death of Oscar Wilde human experience is a very useful exercise. We'll conclude, the end point will eventually be a couple of texts that are very dear to my heart. One is called De Profundis, a letter that he wrote from prison, and the other is called Ballad Read in Jail. But we're going to get there at the very end. But we start instead from the very beginning, and we start in Ireland, because of course Oscar Wilde was born in Ireland in 1854, from two parents who were quite important in the in Irish society of the time. The father, you can see him here, was a leading surgeon. He was also an amateur, but not so amateur, archaeologist and ethnographer. Whereas his mother, you can see her here, she's very attractive and very attractive woman and flamboyant woman in many ways. She was, in a sense, one of the first Irish nationalists. And she also held, she was a passionate writer and poet, and she organized a lot of activities and circles. And in many ways, the seed of Irish nationalism were some even related to Oscar's mother. William Wilde, the father, wrote a very important book, which is called, the precise title, but it's sort of a collection of Irish antiquities. I don't remember exactly the precise name, but I think collection of Irish antiquities is still used nowadays as an encyclopedic work of everything that was ancient in Ireland. Whereas the mother, and I would like to look at her again, was a fantastic personality in many ways. She was she claimed to be a descendant of Dante Alighieri, so she gave herself another name. She was Speranza Wilde. She said that she was a kind of the reincarnation of the Italian Renaissance. And you can see how, in a way, some traits of Oscar Wilde's personality do really come from mum. But what I find interesting in starting to introduce a bit the idea of imagination, that in a sense for Speranza Wilde, imagination is a way to change reality. I mean, of course, she was not a descendant of Dante, but by pretending that she was sending a message. So art and literature somehow for Speranza Wild or Francesca Wild was a way really to shape reality. Reality needs to be shaped by art. And we're going to see that certainly one of the things that Herzog was very much committed to, using art to change the world in a way. But what is also interesting about Oscar Wilde's mom, that she was a very cheerful and very flamboyant character, but she also had a bit of a dark personality. And Oscar himself will remember many years later how often his mother will repeat these words from Goethe to him, who never ate his bread in sorrow, never spent the midnight hours weeping and wailing for the morrow. He knows you not, you heavenly powers. So Francesca Wilde, or Speranza Wilde, as he liked to be called, was a bit of a complex personality. And this personality was somehow shattered in 1867 when her daughter and the sister of Oscar Wilde died very young age. And from that time on, she became very depressed. And this side of his family certainly deeply affected Oscar Wilde himself. Another strange thing about Speranza Wilde is that for some reason we really don't know, she decided to baptize Oscar as a Catholic, which is very strange because her husband, William Wilde, was a deeply anti-Catholic Freemason. So the idea of having a Catholic son didn't really make any sense. So we still don't exactly know why she did it. We know she did it, and we're going to tell you later why we found out about that. But for some reason, Oscar Wilde was a cradle Catholic. He did not convert at the end of his life because he was already a Catholic, but he took the whole life in a way to go back to the beginning of his life adventure. It's quite possible that that Speranza Wilde decided to baptize Oscar because she visited one of the Irish churches in the countryside, and she had a bit of an inspiration and she said, let's do it. So anyway, we have now met the parents of Oscar Wilde. We can move forward a bit, and we move forward to the time in Dublin when he enrolled as a student at Trinity College. And he was so successful, he was immediately recognized as a bit of a genius, that his parents decided to send him to another degree in another place on the other side of the Irish Channel, that is to say Oxford, and in particular Magdalen College, which is a college I'm also affiliated, so I do share a bit with Oscar Wilde. I'm quite happy of this connection, because in many ways some of Oscar Wilde's imagination did develop in the cloisters or in the garden of Magdalen College. When Oscar Wilde came to Magdalen College, Oxford, he became in many ways the Oscar Wilde that we know him. We know in the sense that he started to dress up in a very fancy way. He started to kind of become the center of a student society that attracted these proto-dandies. You can see from a picture of that time in the 1878. It's quite clear how in Oxford, Oscar Wilde fully embraced something that was already there at the beginning in his family, if you want, which is this love for art as a way of life. I mean, his mother was exactly like that, but also his father, to a certain extent, had dedicated most of his life to the study of ancient Irish art. And in particular in Ireland, in Oxford, he met two people that will become his teachers at universities, tutors at university, that will really shape his personality. Again, a quite complex personality. These two people are, one of them is John Ruskin. John Ruskin, again, I don't have the time to speak in depth about John Ruskin, but to kind of sum up in a very simple way the position of John Ruskin towards art, John Ruskin essentially believed, he was a romantic in many ways, he essentially believed that the point of art was to improve reality, especially the reality of 19th century England, which was devastated by the Industrial Revolution. It was devastated by a very low level of education. So what John Ruskin did with his Oxford students, including Oscar Wilde, he went on to the Oxford countryside or the outskirts of Oxford and started to build roads. So when he was a student, Oscar Wilde essentially was digging the road that I take every day to go to college, okay, which was actually built by John Ruskin in the late 70s. But what I'm interested in is the idea, what is imagination, what's art doing in the world? Art has the task to improve, to make better reality. So he has a very pragmatic purpose, if you want. On the other side, he met another very influential writer, great theorist, who was Walter Pater, who had a slightly different conception of art. We say not completely different, but somehow slightly different conception of art. And this idea is that art should not really be pragmatic. Art should not really engage with the material world. Art should really go beyond that. In a way, art is a way to go beyond the materiality of art. It is still a kind of romantic position to a certain extent, but of a very different kind. Just to quote a short sentence from Pater, Pater used to say that art had the task to burn always with a heart gem-like flame to maintain the ecstasy. So art is almost an ecstatic, a mysterious experience. Art should not really try to do anything with reality. Art should go against reality almost, beyond reality. There is almost something religious about art. Pater was the inventor of the motto Ars Gratia Artis, not the inventor, but the one who popularized it, which means basically art for art's sake. Art does not have a purpose whatsoever. It's not like John Ruskin. We come back to these two positions, okay? They seem very different, but actually they're not so different. But let's say that, to simplify, one is a pragmatic conception of art. So art has a pragmatic purpose. Bill Rhodes in the Oxford countryside or the Oxford peripheries. And the other instead is more art go beyond the material reality. In Oxford, while following his father's footsteps, joined the Freemasonry, again, without going to too many details, but joining Freemasonry essentially is to join the road to success in English establishment. If you are in the late 19th century, you want to become someone in the British society, you need to be a Freemason. And so in a way for Oscar Wilde to become a Freemason is essentially to embark on a journey towards success. But at the same time, and it's again quite mysterious, he falls into the fascination of the second spring of British Catholicism, namely John Henry Newman and his legacy. Oscar Wilde himself meets one day John Henry Newman, who comes to Oxford to preach at the Oxford Oratory, but in general his closest friends become members of the, let's say, the Catholic second spring, and they try very, very, very hard to convert him. They have converted from the Anglican Church, and they take as a bit of as a mission to make sure that Oscar Wilde converts to the Catholic Church. And at that time, I don't think that Oscar Wilde was even aware that he was a Catholic. But they start doing some journeys. They take him to Rome. So Oscar Wilde goes to Rome, and they even organize a meeting with the Pope, with Pope Pius IX. And Pius IX tells Oscar Wilde, you really should convert. But the problem with that is that Oscar Wilde has also other friends, indeed members of the Freemasonry, that basically are very worried about all this and decide instead to take him and try to convert him into, I quote, a Hellenized pagan. And for a few years, for 4 or 5 years in Oxford, we have got these two forces that really try to get the soul, if you want, of Oscar Wilde. And Oscar Wilde really gets very, very close. He will write to one of his friends, Catholic friends, if I could hope that the church will wake in me some earnestness and purity, I will go over as a luxury, if not for better reasons. But I can hardly hope he would. And to go over to Rome would be to sacrifice and give up my two great gods, money and ambition. And money because, of course, Oscar Wilde knew very well that if he had become a Catholic, his father would immediately stop funding his endeavors. So they struggle for a while. There is a moment in which he goes very, very, very close because he has, I won't go into the details, but a kind of a very deep crisis, personal crisis. So he goes to the London Oratory and he goes to confess with one of the priests there, and who says to him basically, yeah, come back next week and then we'll talk about it. And that's the letter that he wrote. In fact, you see, a quote from here. My dear Mr. Wilde, whatever your first part of me had been your visit yesterday, it was God's grace that made you do this. Trust then you will come on Thursday. So he sets an appointment on Thursdays, come back on Thursday, and we'll talk more about it. But the following Thursday, Oscar Wilde doesn't come and sends instead a large box full of lilies. And that's the end of it for many decades, essentially. Not many decades, for a few decades. But again, we need to understand a bit what's going on there, because in a sense, Oscar Wilde, that's why I like this Catholic imagination in an etymological sense. There are two different sides of Oscar Wilde's personality, and this, ideally, we'd like to have both. He will have both the kind of the success, the love for art and whatever, and then he will also kind of keep the Catholic, the religious identity. But he at a certain point, he has to choose. And for, at the beginning, he chooses, in a way, the other way, and decides to follow really his father's wish to settle down as a bourgeois, in a way. And he marries, in particular, a woman who is, you can see her, she's Constanza Wilde. And again, he marries her just because of the money, to be honest. Okay, so it's, I mean, maybe he's in love at the beginning with her, okay, but it's a very pragmatic consideration. At the same time, he has a family. You see, also has a son. This is Cyril's favorite son. And at the same time, after graduating from Oxford, he starts to develop a bit more his philosophy, his kind of theory of imagination. He does it in a strange way because he does not do it in England or Ireland, but he does it in the States. He goes to the United States and he starts giving a series of lectures, mainly in American universities. And he dresses up in a strange way, bringing sunflowers, and he becomes a bit of a, I would say, viral, if you would use the analogy. So he has, doesn't do YouTube videos, but he becomes a bit like a bit like that. So he's very famous. A lot of people attack him. He goes to Harvard and people throw tomatoes at him. He starts to kind of develop a bit of a persona, of a poser, that somehow really recalls what I was saying about his mom, in a way. So he's not really him. He's kind of uses imagination and his love for beauty to, in a sense, create something, which is his own persona. And it's a persona that he stayed there for, in a way, to the rest of his life. This is a picture taken by around this year, so you can really see a bit the size of the personality. He dresses very well. I mean, he has this sort of desire really to become very impactful. But then something begins to happen. And I think I chose this picture because I think this picture really clarifies very well what begins to happen. And you see, this is on the left. Is Constanza Wilde when they marry, about the same year, very pretty, very attractive. That's Constanza Wilde a few years later when she's now a mom of a son, and you can see even from the picture that she's a bit different. I mean, I quote this because Oscar Wilde himself is obsessed by this. He's obsessed by the fading of the beauty of his wife. He finds it a very problematic thing, and he sees this as a sort of a slap into his face in his aesthetic mission. How can I be married with an ugly woman, okay? But again, he's obsessed with this idea, but deep down there is something deeper there, which is how can an artist like I am be content with ugliness? I need to do something beautiful in my life. I have a mission, which is the mission of beauty, and therefore I need to find a kind of a space which is not bourgeois, which is not like meaningless, which is not apparently ugly as the family life seemed to him. Again, poor Constanza Wilde. I'm quoting this just because Oscar is himself is very much obsessed with this. He was very, very shocked by this change from the beginning to the development of the marriage. And this is I use this example to introduce then what Oscar starts to do in the following years, in the decade from the 1880 to the 1889, the period I will call the apprentice of Anesti. He is graduated from university. He's now kind of settled down financially because he married a very rich woman. And but at the same time, if he has this urge to set the tone of the conversation in the intellectual life of the London of the time. What is therefore aestheticism? What is the position of Oscar Wilde in the 80s also made him famous? And again, we may laugh at it in the sense of it's something hedonist, it's something that we should reject, but actually it's something which I find very attractive. I mean, deep down, the aestheticist position of Oscar Wilde is very true. There is something very beautiful about it. And I quote from a letter where, in a sense, he explains, where does the position come from, what the philosophy of life comes from. And I quote, "I remember when I was at Oxford," and this is a quote from De Profundis, a text will come back later. "I remember when I was at Oxford saying to one of my friends, and we were strolling around Magdalen's narrow, bird-haunted walks, that I wanted to eat of the fruit of all the trees in the garden of the world. And I was going out into the world with that passion in my soul." So at the beginning of this aestheticist position, there is this love for the gardens of the world. Of course, there is also the sort of the sinful the subtext, okay? But what you find there is not exactly a sinful thing. I mean, it's a desire of beauty, is a desire, it's an attraction even towards reality. And this position is a position that Oscar Wilde calls the true realist position. Let me quote also this letter. Just four quotes that I think really helped to illustrate what is the position of Oscar Wilde, especially in the 80s. The artist can accept no sphere of life in exchange for life itself. For him, there is no escape from the bondage of the earth. There is not even the desire of escape. He's indeed the true realist. What does that mean? What's the position of Oscar Wilde? The position of Oscar Wilde essentially is we are like set in the bondage of the earth, so we are living the material world, but our task is to give sense to the material world, is to give life to the material world, is to fight for the beauty of the material world. We cannot really... So in many senses, a romantic position is an anti-positivist position, it's an anti-materialistic position, which to a certain extent is completely to accept and in fact embrace. Aestheticism is therefore a quest, is a search. I quote, aestheticism is a search after the science of the beautiful. It is the science of the beautiful through which men set the correlation of the arts. It is, to speak more exactly, the search after the secret of life. So you see, it's not an escapist. It's not like withdrawing from life. It's not a hedonist as a sort of self-pleasure and exercise. It is actually for Oscar Wilde, as it was for Peter and Ruskin, his masters, a very, very serious endeavor. The artist needs to give beauty to the world. Beauty, in fact, is the only thing that time cannot harm. Philosophy follow like sand, and creeds follow one another like the withered leaves of autumn. What is beautiful is a joy for all seasons and a possession for all eternity. So we really see here how Ruskin and Peter come together. On the one hand, art is something transcendent, and art is able to produce something which is timeless, which is eternal, which is, but at the same time, is something that is almost pragmatic because it needs to give meaning to the world. It's a quest within this world. So the mission of the artist, as he articulates in these lectures that he's giving around the world and in these booklets that he's publishing at this time, is essentially to create beautiful things. The artist is a creator. And what that means, I mean, let me just quote a very simple anecdote from his American tour, which gave him the initial success. He goes to visit a coal mine in the US, and then he's going down in a bucket, and he starts to kind of make very, very fancy poses, adding beauty to the particular place. And he says in a letter at the time, so off we drove, the miners carrying torches before us, till we came to the shaft and were shot down in buckets. Of course, true to my principle, being graceful even in a bucket. And you see, I like the idea, I mean, it's quite prosaic, but you see, it's a cave, down the cave. In a Platonic sense, I mean, this is not escaping the cave. The artist does not escape the cave. The artist goes into the cave, but brings beauty to the cave. Brings beauty which is not there, it's external, he's himself bringing the beauty. The cave remains dark and ominous, but the artist is the one that kind of give sense to what otherwise would be just a very depressing coal mine. At the same time, you can see how this position is itself also a bit problematic, because this position, which is a position that considers reality a bit like a cave, naturally leads him to start having a distrust of reality, as he says. As he writes in this text, art, and then I close on this, but we start really to understand a bit better what he means by aestheticism. Art takes life as part of a rough material, recreates it, so refreshes it in fresh forms, and keeps, that's a key passage, between herself and reality, the impenetrable barrier of beautiful style, of decorative or ideal treatment. That's, I really ask your attention on this call because I think it's key. So you see, beauty creates this impenetrable barrier of beautiful style. So reality is dark, it's like a mine. So what does beauty do? It kind of creates a barrier from the ugliness of reality. And this barrier is the beautiful style that kind of keeps away what is on the other side. So what basically Oscar Wilde says in around these years is art needs to defend human being from the ugliness of the world, from the pain of the world, from the suffering of the world, from everything which is ugly, meaningless in the world. And that's the purpose of art. That's, I think, in a nutshell, what Oscar Wilde lives, but it's not exactly what he writes about. Because in the same years, when he's touring first the US and then England to spread his gospel of aestheticism. He's also writing a few short stories that I'm sure you're very familiar with, The Happy Prince or The Selfish Giant. I guess you've heard about them. If not, please do go and read The Fairy Stories of Oscar Wilde, which are very beautiful. Because at the same time where he's kind of preaching the idea that art needs to create this barrier, he writes a lot of short stories in the same years where are all about destroying the barrier. You're all about embracing, in a Catholic sense, if you want, the whole of reality. Again, I don't know if you're familiar with The Selfish Giant, for instance, but The Selfish Giant is a story of a giant who lives alone in this sort of enclosed house, and outside you got little children playing, and the whole story essentially is the giant eventually decided to destroy the walls and going out. Or if you think about The Happy Prince or The Young King, it's the same kind of idea of an artist-like figure, a giant in the sense of be higher than others, or a king or a prince, who is living a bit in a bubble, the bubble of beauty, where everything is beautiful, and then is sort of invited at the end of the story to go outside and discover also that reality, but also the meaning of suffering and pain. And let me just read a couple of quotes to understand how the two things come together in the 80s, while he's actually preaching the aestheticism, but in this literary work, in a prophetic way, we really see the heart of Oscar Wilde coming out. As he said in De Profundi, and he's really talking about these years, I confine myself so exclusively to the trees, what seemed to me the sunlit side of the garden. See, he wanted to have all the gardens of the world, but not really all the gardens, only the sunlit side of the garden. And shunned the other side for its shadow and its gloom. I used to live entirely for pleasure. I shunned suffering and sorrow of every kind. I hated both. So you see, the aestheticist position deep down is rooted in this desire to shun suffering and sorrow, to shun the other side of reality. But as I was saying, inside the story that is written in the very years, we have exactly the opposite thing. And a quote, for example, a quote from The Young King, which says exactly the opposite. Never before, that's the end of the story, had the king felt so keenly or with such exquisite joy the magic and the mystery of beautiful things. And the young king looked at them and they were beautiful. That's the aestheticist position. But he remembered his dreams and he said to his lords, take all these beautiful things away, for I will not wear them. For on the loom of sorrow and by the white hands of pain has this my robe been woven. There is blood in the heart of the robe and death in the heart of the pearl. So you see, again, I invite you to read the story to understand all the implications, but you have the sort of idea of a young king who is discovering that the beautiful things that his lords are giving to him are really not everything. There is something beyond that. There is something beyond the palace where he lives. And the same kind of dynamic is found in The Happy Prince. If you remember, The Happy Prince is the story of the prince who is, in his afterlife, if you want, learns to discover the pain and the suffering of his people. And in a dialogue with a little swallow, he will say at the very end, "Dear little swallow," said the prince, "you tell me of marvelous things, but more marvelous than anything is the suffering of men and women. There is no mystery so great as misery." This is a very beautiful contradiction, and also why I personally love art so much, because you can have your philosophies, you can have your convictions, your beliefs, but then art, in a sense, doesn't lie. So art kind of reveals what is actually going on in the heart of Oscar Wilde in the period. And while he's on the one side preaching the idea of creating a beautiful barrier, instead in his short stories of the same time, he's talking about the embracing of suffering as something which really needs to be accepted. And that's something that Oscar Wilde himself says, so it's not really me saying that, because Oscar Wilde himself in the letter will acknowledge how prophetic, in a way, these short stories were at the time. The other half of the garden had its secrets for me also. And of course, all of this is foreshadowed and prefigured in my books, some of it in The Happy Prince, some of it in The Young King. So Oscar Wilde himself, because he believes that art is prophetic in the sense that it's transcendent, because it goes to the truth of reality even more than any sort of philosophy, will in his particular case eventually foreshadow what was going to happen to him, which is not exactly what is happening to him in his real life of the time. because in the 80s, and especially starting from 1989, certainly Oscar Wilde is not living in that side of the garden, but is really living in the bright side. And from 1889 to 1895, we really have what one could call the gilded years of Oscar Wilde. And I'm referring with the idea of gilding to the Happy Prince, who is at the beginning all gilded and eventually needs to kind of get rid of the gold to give it to the poor people. So the gilded years begin 1889, and they begin again. I'll cut a long story short, or better, we'll quote maybe the most astute critic of Oscar Wilde, who describes very well what's going on in the period. And this person is, of course, another great man, James Joyce, who said, only with the presentation of his brilliant comedies, because that's really what's happening in the late 80s and early 90s, did Wilde enter the short last phase of his life, luxury and wealth, 89 to 85. He became the standard of elegance in the metropolis, and the annual income from his writings reached almost half a million francs, and he scattered his gold among a series of unworthy friends. In the early 90s, Oscar Wilde really becomes famous, really reaches success. He was already kind of well-known before, but in the 1890s, really becomes super, super successful. His plays are seen by hundreds of thousands of people in London. He makes a lot of money. These are really the gilded years, and again, maybe you're getting, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but you can read how successful and influential Oscar Wilde is in those years. He goes to Paris, he travels to Europe. I mean, he's really become one of the most important writers of the time. And yet, even then, there is something which is a bit dark. Even then, when everything seems gilded, his art will reveal something different. He himself will say in a letter to Bozzi, now we need to introduce Bozzi, who is a key character to understand Oscar Wilde of the time. In a letter to his lover, Bozzi was a young boy that Oscar Wilde was dating and having as a relationship whilst he with his wife, so he had this sort of dark side of his life. He would really say that death and love seem really to work together, even in this time. It's a time where there is all the gilding, but in fact, there's a very dark side which goes on, which is, again, don't want to open the issue of homosexuality there, but we are really talking about pederasty, pedophily, if not even murder in some cases. So we got a dark side that at the moment is hidden, but will eventually come out very clearly. But before then, even in the 1890s, again, art doesn't lie. And Oscar Wilde will write what was by far his most successful work, which is The Picture of Dorian Gray, where again we see the truth of what's going on in Oscar Wilde's life at the moment. And here again, we really start seeing how the Catholic imagination starts to develop even more clearly. I think it was there from the very beginning. I think that everything in the imagination of Dorian Gray is Catholic, but there is a development in the sense that it becomes even clearer and more open and more complete. And in many ways, The Picture of Dorian Gray is the most Catholic work of Oscar Wilde. That's not something that I say. Again, let me quote again what James Joyce says, that was a very, very astute reader. Here, and here in The Picture of Dorian Gray, we touch the pulse of Wilde's art, sin. He deceived himself into believing that he was the bearer of good news of neopaganism to an enslaved people, the vision of aestheticism. His own distinctive qualities he placed at the service of a theory of beauty, which according to him was to bring back the golden age and the joy of the world's youth. Really, that's really what art was doing, by creating this barrier to protect human beings from the darkness of the world, we will be able to create again the golden age. And instead, in The Picture of Dorian Gray, written in a way at the very peak of his fame, at its very base, there is instead a truth inherent in the soul of Catholicism, that man cannot reach the divine heart except through the sense of separation and loss called sin. And of course, James Joyce is critical in this essay, okay, because James Joyce is basically, the whole point is to show how Oscar Wilde was the opposite of what he's pretending to be, but he was a kind of a simple Catholic bigot beyond the glitter. So James Joyce is quite critical, but I think in many ways, he's very correct in the kind of description of the picture of Dorian Gray, which since it's late, I won't be able to discuss with you. I hope, have you read The Picture of Dorian Gray? I guess most of you have read The Picture of Dorian Gray. But in The Picture of Dorian Gray, without talking about all the details, it's very clear how The Picture of Dorian Gray reveals what is the essence of what is really in the essence of the guild, that the patina that Rawal is building around it. In the, let me just quote a couple of words that Oscar Wilde himself says at a certain point. Let me jump here at least. So let me just say what Oscar Wilde says about the moral of the Picture of Dorian Gray and how it connects to the issue of Catholic imagination we're talking about. The moral of this novel is this: all excess as well as renunciation brings to its own punishment. One of the key ideas is really like choose one versus the other. Excess of renunciation brings a punishment. Then we got the painter, Basil Hall, while worshipping physical beauty far too much, dies by the hand of one in whose soul he has created most of that absurd vanity. Dorian Gray, having led a life of mere sensation and pleasure, tries to kill conscience and at the moment kills himself. Long Harry Wotton seeks to be merely the spectator of life. If only those who rejected the battle are more deeply wounded than those who take part in it. Again, I don't have the time to discuss all this because it's quite late, so I really want to go to a bit forward. But what is quite clear, how that's really what great art does. Catholic art is able to look at all the different sides of his personality, because in a sense, all the three characters are part of Oscar Wilde's personality to a certain extent, and keep bringing them back to the whole, bring them back to a Catholic vision, if you want, to a kind of complete vision, not just a particular vision, not just a detail, but you get the whole picture, if you want, in this very beautiful novel. At the same time, this novel is also almost allegorically talking about this dark side of Oscar Wilde's personality, which is associated with this character of Bosie, of this young boy that Oscar Wilde falls in love with and who will basically bring him to his destruction. And Bosie, again, apart from, again, the sexual, homosexual connotations, okay, I'm more interested in what he means for Oscar Wilde in the context of an imagination. What he represents, and again, Oscar Wilde says it, he essentially represents his own vision of art. Dear, dear boy, you are more to me than any one of them has any idea. You are the atmosphere of beauty to which I see life. You are the incarnation of all lovely things. So essentially, Bosie is the embodiment of his ideal, okay, of this almost illusion, because it is an illusion that one can live a life all gilded. He's in a way the embodiment of gilding, in a sense. And he does believe in this embodiment for quite a while, and he destroys his life for it, because he will, at a certain point, his father-in-law will find out about this affair. His father-in-law has given him his young daughter, and he decides to intervene. And in 1894, 1895, we have one of the most sensational trial of the time of the late 19th century, which is a trial that will bring Oscar Wilde to prison. Again, I don't have the details to read all the discuss all the implications of the trial, but this is a complete earthquake for the life of Oscar Wilde. And not just because he loses everything and goes to prison, but because it is as if everything he has been building up for the few years is completely exposed in its vanity. He will lose everything. He will lose his wife, his children, he will lose his money, he will lose his reputation, and he will go to spend 2 years in the prison of Reading with common criminals. Again, that's something that in 21st century we cannot even imagine, okay? But for a man like this, it is really something that completely shattered his personality, and as he says himself, in a way, Oscar Wilde comes out of prison as a complete broken man. In fact, he will live just for a few years after that. Normally, people will stop here. So we stop in 1895. So the whole of Oscar life stops here. And the last few years are kind of neglected, both from a biographical and from a literary point of view. But in fact, these 5 years are in a way the most important years, because these are the years where everything comes to completion. It's the years in which, in a sense, everything that he himself prefigured in his work, you remember the young king, the happy prince, it's all about the discovery of suffering. It's all about understanding the reality. It's not just this illusion of pain or of beauty, but there is also pain, and pain is part of our reality. We cannot escape it. That's essentially the experience that Oscar Wilde will have in prison. And it's an experience that will produce two great masterpieces that which I strongly invite you to read. One of them is called De Profundis, which is a letter that he writes for Bose himself, for the young boy he was in love with. It's in a way a letter of love, but much deeper than just a letter of love. And it's also the letter when he talks about his conversion, or better, not yet a conversion, but he's just like the Happy Prince. This is a beautiful drawing of a Happy Prince that was done by a friend of mine. But it's really the Catholic development of a personality which so far had tried every possible way not to face the whole of reality. And that's where his imagination in a way fully develops. Not neglecting or denying the past, okay? Because in a way his love for beauty is still there, but going out, I mean, destroying the world, destroying the illusion of a barrier. And let me read Oscar Wilde's own words to describe this, because I think they're very telling. And in this letter, essentially, tells Bosi what happened to him. And let me quote. There is no truth comparable to sorrow. Other things may be illusions of the eye or the appetite, made to blind the one and cloy the other. But out of sorrow have the worlds been built. And of the birth of a child or a star, there is a pain. So the De Profundis is, first of all, the embracing of pain and suffering. Again, we need to imagine him a bit. I mean, he's in a kind of, not in a prison with common criminals, okay? And the prison in the late 19th century, Victorian, in Britain, is not exactly a very nice place to be, okay, in any possible way. So the experience of sorrow, in a sense, is unavoidable for him. But within this experience of sorrow, he discovers, just like the characters of his fairy stories written more than a day, 10 years before, the truth of reality and even the truth of his aestheticist aspirations. There is about sorrow an intense and extraordinary reality, for the secret of life is suffering. You remember what he was saying, aestheticism is the quest for the secret of life, to understand the secret, to find the secret of life. And here he says, the secret of life is suffering. It is what is hidden behind everything. So we see how beauty and pain, that's really Catholic in a way, in this letter come together. One does not have to choose between one of the two, but they start, that's how I start to discover them in his experience as something that is all real. And again, I will jump on this because if I have 5 minutes, I will show you a small video where we get 3-4 minutes of the whole voice of Oscar Wilde. But this is a very beautiful letter, not just because he discovers the experience of pain, he embraces the experience of pain, and therefore, in a sense, it is as his beauty becomes more real, more complete. Ratzinger, a few years ago, I was there actually when he gave the beautiful speech, explained what is Christian beauty. And the Christian beauty, he says, Ratzinger, Christian beauty is a beauty which has pain in it. That's why the crucifix is the full embodiment of Christian beauty, because it's a beauty of love which also embraces also pain. There is nothing more beautiful than the crucifix, for Joseph Ratzinger, because it's the place, it's the moment where really beauty and pain come together. And that's exactly the experience that Oscar Wilde has in these years, because this is also the experience when he starts to open up the way for Lord Christ to enter in. And it's I found again how beautiful how resonant your life and work are in the experience of Oscar Wilde. It is the place where his heart begins to break. In a way, just like in The Happy Prince, the heart of Oscar Wilde was unable to break, was closed to the others. Instead, in reading Jail, it is the moment where the heart of Oscar Wilde breaks open in a way. And as I will say in the other beautiful text that he produces from prison, which is called The Ballad of Reading Jail, the broken heart is the only way for a true, real encounter with Christ. And I quote, a happy day whose hearts can break and peace of pardon win. And in De Profundis, he talks about his heart that has been broken. How else may man make straight his plan and cleanse his soul from sin? How else but through a broken heart may Lord Christ enter in. Beautiful text for a beautiful poem, which I strongly recommend you to read. And that's really like the other side of the experience that Oscar Wilde has in Jail. is the experience of pain and suffering, but also the revelation and the acknowledgement of the beauty that there can there be in the experience of suffering. But it's also the first, the beginning of a relationship with Christ. And I quote again from the De Profundis here. There is something so unique about Christ. He does not really teach one anything, but by being brought into his presence, one becomes something. And everybody is predestined to his presence. Once at least in his life, each man walks with Christ to Emmaus. All who come in contact with his personality, even though they may neither bow to his altar, he's not really a Catholic yet, he's not bowing to his altar, nor kneel before his priest, yet somehow find the ugliness of the sins is taken away, and the beauty of the sorrow is revealed to them. So the way this the sorrow can be embraced and beauty can be found in the sorrow is also to Christ in this letter. So that's really like the main experience that he has in the Ballad of Red in Jail and in the Profundis, which I strongly recommend you to read, even though he is not a Catholic yet, in a way. He's not, he's not really bowing to his altar. The life of Oscar Wilde is a journey. It's not like black and white. I mean, it's a journey that starts from the very young age and continues until the very death. When he comes out of prison, he has some very miserable life. He's not Catholic yet. I mean, even if he is, because that's something that will be only found out at the end of his life, but he knows it, but he's not really clearly aware of it, but he's not really converted yet, okay? And in fact, the last year of his life, when he comes out of prison, he has the final tragedy of his life. When he comes out of prison, he writes a very beautiful letter to his wife, and he begs her to take him back. And his wife, who really loves him, decides to do it, in a way. At the same time, there is another one who is writing to him letters, who is Bosi again, who is basically again inviting him to come back to him. He asks forgiveness. Sorry, it was all my fault. If you went to prison, it was my father who destroyed your life. Let's come back together. And Oscar Wilde is there, like having to choose between going back to his wife and his family and going with Bosi, and he decides to go with Bosi. So he goes to Rome and Naples, but then the same experience that he had with his wife will be repeated in this case. Because as soon as Bosi sees him, you can see him there, very ugly, with no teeth. I mean, we don't see that, but he has lost his teeth in prison. He's now a very ugly man. He's completely destroyed. He's no longer the fashionable, viral influencer of the 1890s, okay? Of the 1880s. Bosi stays with him a couple of days and then goes away and leaves him there alone. So his wife had now given up. I mean, he tries again to write a letter, but his wife says, okay, that's it. So we never see his wife and his children again. And he will spend the last couple of years of his life in Paris as a beggar, basically. So he will die in Paris, begging his life with his friends, getting drunk, especially drinking Ascension. He will spend a couple of miserable years. But again, there is something going on in those 2 years, because from the letters that he writes in 1897 and 1898, he in a sense, will complete his journey. And I quote, "My desire to live is as intense as ever. And though my heart is broken, hearts are made to be broken." This is why God sent salt, the first to before, but let me go to the final one. You need to trust me because I didn't put it in the presentation. But essentially, when he's there, he's playing again with the idea of converting to the Catholic Church. He's starting to write to his Catholic friends. And especially, there is one friend in particular, which is called Robbie, who was the one who had introduced him to homosexuality at the very beginning, out of all paradoxes. He was a Catholic in Cambridge. And at the very end of his life, Oscar Wilde writes a letter to his friend Robbie, who is also homosexual, Catholic, in Paris, and he decides at the end to convert. And that's something that he talks a lot in his final letters. I just quote one. Again, don't focus on the details, but it's more like to get the sense of what the kind of experience that Oscar Wilde is living in Paris at the end of his life. "Much of my moral obliquity is due to the fact that my father would not allow me to become a Catholic, in a way that..." Which is true, you know, to a certain extent. "The artistic side of the church and the fragrance of his teaching will have cured my degeneracies and intend to be received before long." And in fact, at the end of his life, he called Robbie Ross, who was this young boy, not exactly a very nice man, who had introduced him to Bosi among all the others. And he asked Robbie Ross to call a priest, and a priest comes, and there is this Robbie Ross, this beautiful in a beautiful testimony tells that the Oscar at the end was not even able to speak, but he asked for confession. But the point is that he does not really become a Catholic because he was already a Catholic. So even there is a bit of ambiguity about the ceremony to be had in that very moment. Oscar will die as a Catholic. But again, I don't think the point is to rejoice that he became a Catholic at the end of his life. And the point is that, in a sense, his final conversion was the end of a journey. And every step of the journey somehow were kind of prefiguring and were leading into this particular encounter, which is the final encounter that he made in his life. Good. I will now conclude, but sorry, if you bear with me for 3 or 4 minutes, I just would like to sum up the journey that we did together, before we go there, and just listen for 3 minutes a video from De Profundis, which I made, which is kind of some of the beautiful quotes of De Profundis. De Profundis is a text with a very strange editorial history, because this text is forbidden to be, for 6 decades, is buried in a safe in London, because Bosi does not want to publish it, and Robbie Ross doesn't want to publish it, so only fragments of it are published, and it will come up only after the Second World War. So for 50, 60 years, this text was still hidden. And it's a text which essentially Oscar Wilde talks about his life story, his understanding that all his statist position had to be completed in the experience of sorrow. Is the letter we talked about his encounter with Christ, not yet in the same way of the end of his life, but it's kind of leading there. But I will shut up here. I will let you listen to the words of Oscar Wilde. This is a short video we did with a couple of friends. And all the quotes are original quotes from Oscar Wilde, and I think that's the best way to conclude.
I remember when I was at Oxford saying to one of my friends that I wanted to eat of the fruit of all the trees in the garden of the world, and that I was going out into the world with that passion in my soul. And so indeed I went out, and so I lived. There was nothing I said or did that did not make people wonder. Whatever I touched made beautiful in a new mode of beauty. To truth itself, I gave what is false, no less than what is true as its rightful province, and showed that the false and the true are merely forms of intellectual existence. I treated art as the supreme reality, and life as a mere moment of fiction. I used to live entirely for pleasure. I shunned suffering and sorrow of every kind. I resolved to ignore them as far as possible. They were not part of my scheme of life. I did not want to eat my bread in sorrow. I had no idea that it was one of the special things that the fates had in store for me. Failure, disgrace, poverty, sorrow, despair, suffering, tears even. The broken words that come from lips in pain. Remorse that makes one walk on thorns. Conscience that condemns. I was forced to taste each of them in turn. To feed on them. To have for a season, indeed, no other food at all. But while there were times when I rejoiced in the idea that my suffering was to be endless, I could not bear them to be without meaning. Now I find hidden somewhere away in my nature something that tells me that nothing in the whole world is meaningless, and suffering least of all. There is about sorrow an intense and an extraordinary reality. There are times when sorrow seems to me to be the only truth. Out of sorrow have the worlds been built, and at the birth of a child or a star there is pain. And if the world has indeed been built of sorrow, it has been built by the hands of love, because in no other way could the soul of man, for whom the world was made, reach the full stature of its perfection. Pleasure for the beautiful body, but pain for the beautiful soul. I have lain in prison for nearly 2 years. Out of my nature has come wild despair. It was a blow so appalling that I did not know what to do. So I flung myself on my knees and bowed my head and wept. That moment saved me. It was my soul in its ultimate essence that I had reached. When one comes in contact with the soul, it makes one simple as a child, as Christ said one should be. There is something so unique about Christ. He does not really teach one anything, but by being brought into his presence, one becomes something. All who come into contact with his personality, even though they may neither bow to his altar nor kneel before his priest, yet somehow find that the ugliness of their sins is taken away and the beauty of their sorrow is revealed to them. I've said that behind sorrow, there is always sorrow. It were wiser still to say that behind sorrow, there is always a soul. When I say that I'm convinced of these things, I speak with too much pride. Far off, like a perfect hell, one can see the city of God. It is so wonderful that it seems as if a child could reach it on a summer's day. And so a child could.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.